Okay, Noel, I am going to start us with an introduction, and we'll be set to go.
Okay.
So let me formally welcome everyone to today's audio conference workshop entitled Children of Trauma, Understanding and Partnering in Their Healing Process. Today's session will be led by Nola Carew, who is Assistant Professor of Social Work at Cornerstone University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Nola also has over 20 years of practice experience working with children and families in as a coordinator of a federally funded trauma treatment program for adopted children and families through Bethany Christian Services. NOLA's audio conference will assist helping professionals to develop a clear understanding of definitions and types of traumatic experiences in children. Special attention will be given to working with children who have experienced chronic or complex trauma in the form of abuse or neglect. This workshop will address biological, psychological, and social impacts of trauma to help social workers provide more effective assessment of and intervention for affected children over the course of their development. Just before we begin our session, let me just quickly cover a few important housekeeping items. For parts of today's session, because we'll have 45 or 50 people, we'll be using a muting function to eliminate any background noise that might compete with NOLA's presentation. Crying babies, barking dogs, be surprised how they multiply really fast. However, at several different intervals, we will be disabling that muting function so we can enter a live mode for question and answer. So just be aware that during the live portions of the conference, any background noise in your home or office can be heard by all the other participants. So particularly for those parts of the session, if you can keep that background noise minimized, that will make it a much better session for all. A reminder that today's conference call will be recorded for folks who wanted to listen in but weren't able to participate. And it's just, again, part of our making sure you know that the session will be a recorded one. If it's at all possible, we recommend that you follow online the PowerPoint presentation that we provided access to when you registered for the audio conference. If for some reason you haven't been able to access this outline, please let me know via email right away, rick@nacsw.org. And I'll email you something so that you have it there in front of you, but that can be a helpful aid for you as you're listening to the conference. And then lastly, during question and answer periods, please do your best to keep questions and comments crisp and to the point so we can keep the session moving at a good pace. Again, with a larger group, keeping things on track is an important priority. So now without any further ado, I'm delighted to present our audio conference speaker, Nola Carew. It's all yours, Nola.
Thank you. All right. Well, welcome, everybody. Good afternoon or morning or whatever it is for wherever you're at. And appreciate you joining in with me. That was a lot of information that I think I said I was going to cover today in 2 hours. So hopefully we'll get through that. What I would like you, if you have your PowerPoint that Rick mentioned, is the first part. There's two of them. And the first one is called Growing Flowers. And I would like for you to just look at that one if you can. If you don't have it, then just hopefully you can visualize with me. I'm a pretty visual person, so I thought it would be helpful for us to start out with just envisioning this trauma from just stepping outside of it and easing into it a little bit. And also, one other thing that I wanted to mention before I forget is that I do have a resource list that I have emailed to Rick, and he indicated that if you would like that, you could email him and he'll get that to you. Sorry for the lateness of that, but I wanted to make sure I had all of the things on there that give credit where credit is due, and also further places and resources that you can look if you would like to study the topic further. So let's look at the flower. If you can put your hands out and look at your hands and pretend like there's just a tiny little seed in the middle of your hands. And when you look at that seed, I want you to think about what is that seed and where did it come from and what's it going to be? Is it going to be a squash? Is it going to be a flower? Is it going to be a cucumber? What kind of plant is that going to be? And when we look at that, we think about what is the makeup of that seed, the inherent makeup, those biological aspects of that. What is it that it starts out with? And just hold on to that seed. And let's put it in the ground. So dig a, like a little spot there in the ground, and some of you are going to dig in a really soft, rich, fertile piece of ground there that looks like it's nice and dark. If anybody likes to garden like I do, stick your hands right in there. Some of you might be putting that seed over in another spot that's kind of hard and difficult to dig down in, but either way, we're going to get that seed down in the ground. What I want you to think about with that, when we plant that seed in the ground, is what does that look like? That surrounding around that seed that's going to help it to grow. How fertile is it? How moist is it? How rich is it? What kind of nutrients is that seed going to get? When we think about that, we think about some of those prenatal implications that are impacting that child's ability to head out there in the world once it comes out of the ground. So then the next thing we think about is what's going to happen to that seed once we put it in the ground. And we look at roots developing. Roots are really one of my favorite things to think about, because roots really anchor the plant. And when you think about the anchoring that we need as individuals to be able to grow up out of that ground, there's so much that we need, and to have those solid, strong roots built up down in the ground can just help us so much more to be able to manage the different things that come our way. But in order to grow roots, we need some certain things, don't we? We can't just plant that seed and expect that it's just going to grow, because if it doesn't have any water, if it doesn't have any of the right temperature, I know if we plant it in Michigan right now, out there in the freezing cold with all that wonderful snow we just got this weekend, it's not going to grow. So it needs water, it needs the right temperature, it needs a good soil. And it really just grounds that whole plant, helps keep it steady and strong. And I think about those early stages of development in a child's life when we think about those roots. And just think about some of the kids that you might have worked with and the roots that they've developed, some of the roots that they've formed, and how strong or how solid those roots are. And we're going to talk about that further when we talk about some of the impacts of trauma on the root of the child, that inner core. The other thing about roots that I like to think about is they're under the ground. And when you look at that plant that comes, that little seedling that starts to come out of the ground, we don't see the roots. Unless we pull it out, we can't tell what's in there. We can't always see what that looks like. And it's the same thing with the kids that we work with. We can't always see what's going on inside of them. We can't always see those impacts. We don't exactly know what that looks like. And then if you check out the picture, there's a picture of a person there shoveling. He's got a shovel going down into the ground. And I think about that when we have these roots developing down in the ground, and a shovel comes down and it takes a little chunk off of that root. That can certainly shake that plant, because a little chunk of that root came off, or maybe it was pushed to the side a little bit, and it certainly has an impact on it. But usually that plant's going to be able to bounce back. It's going to be able to keep on going down the road. And I think about that like an acute trauma, that simple trauma, a one-time thing, where something happens and it slams into the root of that plant, and it's traumatizing. It's difficult, but yet it can be worked through. It can move on forward and do pretty well. But then if you think about that shovel going down several times into that root in different spots, and it just keeps slamming into that, and there's one thing after another, that I think about like chronic or complex trauma, which we're going to talk more about during the next couple hours, and how that chronic, those continued slams into that root, those impacts, and just keep those chronic impacts. What does that do to that plant? And if you think about plants, if you like gardening, I do. I spent a lot of time in my garden. God and I talked a lot in my garden this summer, so I learned a lot from him there. But I think about that. What did that do to that root of that plant? And how did that impact its development outside of the ground? Then we head to the seedling. So here you've got your ground, and you've got this little seedling sprouting out of the ground. That's the coolest thing to see, is when you see that fruit there coming on out of the ground. Oh, it finally came out. There it is. What does that seedling need? It's so precious, and it's so fragile. And there's three things that I think about that my plant needs. It needs watering, it needs sunshine, and it also needs nighttime. Sometimes we forget about that nighttime component. The watering part of it, it needs food. It's that food. It needs its basic needs met. It needs to know that it's going to get food. It needs to know that it's going to get that often. Sometimes we have our dry spells, and we see what that happens to plants when they get dry spells and they don't get their basic needs met. And it needs sunshine. certainly needs that sun to come out. And we certainly need that here, too. But anyway, it needs affection. From sunshine, I see like affection or nurturance. It needs to be nurtured. It needs to be warmed. It needs to be just shined out on. But then the nighttime part of it is that sun, if that sun were shining all the time on it, it'd shrivel up. It needs rest. It just needs to rest sometimes, that plant does. And that nighttime provides that opportunity for that cover and that blanket for it just to rest. In that protection time, I think. And what you'll see when we talk about some of the kids that we're working with is that in those three areas, some of those things certainly weren't met. And even when they're outside of that environment, some of those things are still a significant struggle for them to accept, to be able to handle, or to be able to know how to make those things work so that they can grow. I think for us as their social workers and for their parents or their foster parents, adoptive parents, whoever they're with, for them too to try to figure out how to give them water, how to give them sunshine, and how to give them that nighttime and that rest. How do we do that? And that's when we're going to talk about our toolbox today and how to build those skills to help them to get that. So the seedling grows into a flower. Bear with me here, because here we are at our flower stage, which is what we're all waiting for when we plant those seeds in the ground. We certainly want to see some flowers in the summer. And it's a beautiful flower. And we know that all these kids are just beautiful. And they all are in their own unique way. They're all very different, and each one is unique. And when you look at the picture of the flowers there I have on the PowerPoint, you'll see that there's one that's white. It's different than the other ones, but that might not be the one that's had the trauma. It could be the yellow one next to it, because we don't see what's underneath the surface. And we talked about those roots and some of those things that have impacted the makeup of that flower. And that's the part that I think is most difficult for us and for the parents that have these kids in their homes is, I don't understand what's going on with this kid, and I can't figure it out. And because it's beneath the surface, and some of the things that we see on the outside that they're doing don't make any sense. And that's the most fascinating part of it, but there's certainly so many things that we can do to try to figure out. I like the Ms. Frizzle kind of thing, thinking, where we get in the bus and we try to go inside their head to figure out what's going on inside of there. Because certainly that's the best way that we can have an impact with them. So just to recap the flower a little bit, we think about the root system for these kids, that it might be a little bit weaker. There might not be as many roots. It might have lost a few along the way. It might not have had enough water to be able to develop them that strong. So they're weakened a little bit. And when we think about that, you think about when it rains and it pours, how much rain can it soak up? How much rain can those roots handle? How much sun can those roots handle? And sometimes you'll hear parents say things like, they won't let me give them affection. They shrink away, or they react and they get angry. And I think about that with the root system. It's like they can handle a certain amount, but they're used to handling something different. And so all of a sudden we try to give them a whole bunch of it, and they're not sure how to handle that. The same with the rain. And the stem is a part of that development of that root. How much can it handle before it droops? And some stems are amazing in plants that can handle so much. And interestingly, different flowers have stronger stems than other flowers. We go back to the makeup of that seed. Why is it that some kid can handle things so much better than another kid? Some of that has to do with the biological aspects. Some of that has to do when their trauma occurred and the age of development and the resources around them. There's a lot of different things, but their stems are a little bit different. And the petals that we see on the outside, some of those might be really delicate to the touch. And they can handle only a little bit of touch. And we need to be okay with that. And we need to help the people we're working with to be okay with that, to start out gradually with that touch. Some of them might be really rough and coarse, and I know those kids I'm talking about, where those petals are really rough and coarse because they've had a whole lot of handling that hasn't been so good for them. And they don't know how to handle a delicate touch, or they don't know how to handle that when someone gives them that delicate, gentle care. The next thing is about transplanting flowers. And as soon as we finish these flowers, then we'll open up for just a couple of minutes to talk a little bit if you have any questions or thoughts. But transplanting flowers is something that I did a lot when we moved from one house to another. I wanted to take all my flowers with me. And even times at home, I get tired of where my flowers are at, and I move them to a different side of the house. And I know when I move those plants, it takes them a while to get back on track. And sometimes they don't always make it. And maybe that's because I moved them too many times. Or maybe that's because I didn't get all the roots when I moved them. And I dug down in with that shovel and I missed a few. And I forgot to take some things along with me, like a little bit of that soil, to plant along with the new soil. And think about that with the kids that we work with and how many placements some of these kids have had, how many times they've had to move, and how much they've had to leave behind, and how much they've lost along the way. And how it's going to take, what it's going to take, and how it's going to take for them to be able to let the roots settle in and really be able to grow. And I just think from that visual perspective of a plant and how we move it and watching it just gradually over time be able to take shape and form, and how we take that extra special care and that extra special time to say, what does this particular plant need from me? And sometimes what we do is we over-fertilize it because we're thinking, oh my gosh, it's not looking very healthy, so I'm going to douse it with fertilizer every single day, a whole extra, I'm going to give it an extra little scoop there because it just doesn't look good. Well, then I did it a little too much because that plant shriveled right up. It was too much fertilizer. It was too much of that affection, too much of that nurturance, and they couldn't take it. So we really need to spend some time thinking about what does it need. And the sunshine, how much sunshine can I give it before, if it's too much, is it going to droop? Is it going to hide? Is it going to not want that? It needs a mixture. And when we talk about that attachment process, that relationship building, what is it that they need and how can I give it to them in creative ways so that they can take it, so that they can handle it? And the same with the safety and the shelter. One of the most important things that I want to talk about today in the context of everything I talk about is safety, and that the child feels safe where you're going with them. Whatever kind of work that you're doing with them, whatever setting, whatever modality you choose, that safety is key, and that if they don't feel safe, that we need to step back and slow down. Because if they don't feel safe, we're going to talk about that they're feeling triggered, they're feeling then dysregulated, and they're not going to be able to do the work. So most importantly is creating that safety and checking in with them to make sure that they feel safe before we move forward. One of the most important things I've learned about trauma work, and one of the most important things that I see in all the literature that I read about trauma work, is that context of safety. So as we think about this, and I think about growing flowers and growing these traumatized kids to be healthy, whole individuals, I think it requires hope, requires a lot of work, requires commitment and knowledge that we do things well, that we look at what works well and we use that. the skills, digging in, resources, a plan, and a process, certainly a process that creates a unique individual and that they're all going to look different. So there's the context of flowers. So Rick, can we just open it up for just a couple of minutes and then we can jump into some of the heavier stuff? Any questions, thoughts? You're not sleeping, are you?
I'm here.
I'm waking up all of a sudden. I wonder if anybody else who's had that experience.
I couldn't hear that comment.
Nola's primarily asking for folks whether they had any feedback.
I like the plant analogy. It's a great way to think about the trauma issues with children.
All right. Well, why don't we dig into some of the deeper stuff then, shall we?
Nola, if I could jump in for 1 second. This is Tom Veeley, and I joined you about, 7-8 minutes ago.
Okay.
I'm online, and I just kept it quiet while you were talking. So.
Thank you.
Can I just ask before I put the muting function back on, does everyone have all of the presentation, the PowerPoint materials that they need? And if you need anything, again, my email is rick, R-I-C-K, at nacsw.org. Thanks, Nolan. Back to you.
All right. Rick kind of mentioned the learning objective for the day, but I really want to talk about what is trauma, what's acute trauma, what's complex trauma, and looking at biological, psychological, and social impacts, and then filling up the toolbox, which is what most everybody fit in, is learning what are those practical things, just tell me what I can do. And I know every time we go to a workshop, that's usually what we're hoping for, and sometimes we don't get, so I want to make sure that we do some of that today. Just in the context of all of this, I think over the years of my work, it has led me to this path, which I wasn't expecting to head down this path. And working with kids that were in their biological homes with protective service referrals, kids who had substantiated abuse or neglect was where I started out with my work, and working with their biological parents and the kids. Getting to know some of the kinds of things they were experiencing and what kind of impact that was having on them, I'm not sure I was completely aware at the time. And as I headed out into my career down the road, doing wraparound services and then outpatient work with kids and adults and adoptive kids and foster kids, and then heading into an adoption trauma treatment program and getting some training from Bessel van der Kolk and John Breer and some of the more well-known people in trauma, I think that's when my light bulb started to come on in my head, that started to really explain to me what was going on with the kids that I was working with, but it also explained what was going on with me personally, and that I have some of my own stuff from my own history that I think it just made so much sense to me of what my brain does, what it did, and what it continues to do as a result of the trauma that I experienced. So I hope that I can make it come to life for you, because I know what it's like inside my head, and I'd like you to get inside my head today. So that's my goal, is that you'll be able to understand these kids better by understanding that through me, and I really feel like that God wants me to use my experiences to be able to shed some light for these kids who sometimes aren't able to do that on their own. And I had to sit back and think about what makes this Christian social work journey with traumatized kids unique or different. What is it that's so different about what we do? And because I think the tools and the skills that we use across the board are the same. So, but there's three things that come to my mind when I think about this work for me personally, and also I hope for all of you, is what it says in 1 Corinthians 13:13, and that's faith, hope, and love. That we have faith, and that we know that God has a plan, and that He works out His plan, and that He uses that through us. He uses His plan through us, and that difficult experiences really can just be used for His glory down the road. And hope, that God can make us whole again. We're going to talk about things like permanent, lasting, biological changes, differences in the brain structure, things that really seem to be very different and sometimes very long-lasting, and sometimes the word permanent used. And just knowing that that God can work through anything and restore us, and that He can use whatever situation that we've been in to move us forward, and love that... I really, when I with my students that I work with, I really try to instill in them that it's the love that God has asked us, that He's shown for us, that He asks us to show that for everyone, and that we have this love and care that we can express to them in an unconditional way. That's something that many of these kids have never experienced before, and that if they can see that through you, that they can have some hope in themselves as well. So child trauma and traumatic events, there's so many to think about. So I've listed a few, and I'm sure there's more that I haven't listed, and that's okay, because I'm certain you'll come across those very unique events or incidents that are very traumatic to people. But I think about things like war, certainly a lot of that right now, and we've got a lot of veterans coming back that have some significant trauma. Life-threatening injury and illnesses, violence, terrorism. We've had natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, and things like that in the last few years. We certainly have had a number of those around. The the countries, and rape and assaults and murder, those are different kinds of traumatic events that I think we should think on. And on the other side, disrupted attachment, sexual abuse, physical abuse, loss of a parent, neglect, which is something I'm most interested in studying. And then my research that I've been doing says that we neglect because we don't spend much time thinking on that. And that is definitely considered a traumatic event. Emotional abuse, parental substance abuse, parental mental illness, those things sometimes don't come to our mind as quickly when we think about different traumatic events. We think more about sexual abuse and physical abuse, I think. And we want to think on how has parental substance abuse or a parent's mental illness impacted a child. How has that been a trauma? Can they label it as a trauma? Probably not. The child himself or herself probably is not going to. But certainly from what we look at, the literature says there's some significant impacts going on that are looking very much just like the trauma of sexual abuse and physical abuse and what's happening to that kid and their body and their brain. Acute trauma. That's that single incident trauma that we talked about. Probably most of those in the first list that we looked at, the first half of the first side of the list with war and natural disaster, maybe a car accident where someone dies or something like that. Those single incident, one-time events, they're outside the range of normal daily human experience. It's not something that we see happening every single day. And it leaves one feeling helpless to do anything about the situation. Outside our expectation of what we think is going to happen today leaves me feeling helpless at the moment. It's a trauma. Can it have a long-lasting impact? Can it be difficult? Yes. Can we often overcome those and move forward from those? Yes. And some of those on that list, actually, those aren't single incident, which is very true. They could certainly be ongoing, like war could certainly be ongoing and could become more of a chronic type of trauma. and some of the natural disasters certainly bordered on that as well, and the long-lasting events surrounding the following of the disaster could certainly be that long-term trauma as well. But chronic or complex trauma is ongoing and more of the same thing or several different traumas occurring to an individual, usually within the caregiving system is the way the definition goes from the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, that it's usually within the system that's supposed to be the source of care for them that the trauma occurs, which is even more difficult for that child to understand in their brain and in their body and the kinds of impacts that happen as a result of that. Can that be long-lasting from chronic or complex trauma? Absolutely. Can it look different in different kids? Absolutely. Can you have two kids from the same family who've experienced the same thing come out handling it differently, managing things differently? Absolutely. Some of that has to do with their genetic makeup. Some of that has to do with how close they are the proximity to the incident. Several different things surrounding them, what kind of resources were around them and the support that they received. Lots of different variables that come into play there. Sometimes we'll notice the lasting impacts more in the kids that are more aggressive or more displaying of their behaviors, I guess we might say. They're acting them out more. They're more visible. But yet there are other kids out there who will have lasting impacts that we might not notice those under the surface that we're not necessarily seeing. They're keeping it to themselves. Okay. I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the difference between post-traumatic stress disorder and perhaps a complex trauma diagnosis. Because right now we don't have a diagnosis for complex trauma in our DSM, and that certainly is in the works for the next DSM that comes out. There are work groups out there looking at a complex trauma diagnosis for kids, because the post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis just doesn't seem to fit a number of these kids. And here's why I think that some of that is the case. Number one, if we look at three major characteristics of post-traumatic stress disorder, you look at repeated reliving of memories of the traumatic experience is what they're expected to have. These kids don't necessarily have that particular video rewinding through their mind. It's like a person who's gone to war, who saw something that happened, saw their partner die in front of them. These kids are not necessarily reliving it like they might come back and be reliving that and seeing it over and over again, because it was just a part of their everyday life, the chronic trauma, part of everyday life. And when you sit back, especially with maybe neglected kids or kids who've lived with substance abusers, and you say, well, tell me about your trauma, they look at you like you're crazy, because they can't identify their life as a trauma. Tell me about what that event was like. It wasn't an event for them. It was a life for them. So I think that's very different for them in terms of reliving of the memories. Do they relive it through their body in certain ways? Yes, absolutely, I think. But that's where we go down and look at and the other characteristics of PTSD, and the third one being that increased arousal or hyperarousal, hypervigilance, irritability, memory and concentration problems, sleep disturbances, and an exaggerated startle response. Absolutely, we see a number of those things, and because we don't have a diagnosis that quite fits kids, we put them into other areas at times where they might be diagnosed as the hyperactivity or the anxiety disorder or conduct disorder and things like that, because we can't quite cover that with a post-traumatic stress disorder. Avoidance of reminders of the trauma might also be a little bit difficult for them to fit in. There's times when I think they'll do that, but there's other times when they're not necessarily cognizantly doing that. So a little bit different with a complex trauma diagnosis, I think, that we're looking at a little bit more of how is that a developmental trauma and how does that look different in how it's played out for these kids. Excuse me. Okay, so impacts of complex trauma across the biological, psychological, and social is what's up next. Rick, do you want to stop for a second and see if we have any questions? Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Any questions, thoughts about that so far?
I think that's just an excellent point about how a lot of children won't fit this post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis, and so a lot of times they are labeled as, you know, having attention problems, ADHD, or something along those lines. And I'm not a practicing social worker yet. I'm a student right now, but I've observed that at some of my practicum sites, and really, you know, it's really kind of a sad thing, because a lot of those children are maybe receiving treatments that are not going to really be effective, because it's kind of targeting the wrong thing.
Absolutely. I think especially if you think about it like attention deficit disorder or something like that, they could be receiving the wrong type of medication for what they need, and they could also be given the wrong interventions, and the parents could be told the wrong kinds of interventions that might help this kid when they are maybe more hypervigilant than hyperactive. Definitely. Yeah. Any other questions, thoughts?
Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I was in my agency, we use trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah.
And one thing that has really been a struggle for me is that it encourages you to do a trauma narrative with the child, And like you're saying, when it's like a DV situation or something like that, it's really hard for them just to find. The trauma narrative works really well if they've experienced one event in time. But if they have, you know, seen their mom be beaten up for 10 years, how do you get them to do a trauma narrative of that, you know? And so I can see, I don't know, so what would be your advice in that as far as, if it's a complex trauma like that, like you were saying, they've lived it over and over, would you say that the trauma narrative would not work in that case because it's not just a single event?
What I think about that, and I think that TFCBT is considered probably one of the best practices out there for kids these days in the trauma work. What I think is that it's not so much about me describing my experiences, in particular, very clearly my experience about what happened in the domestic violence, because it happened over and over again. It's hard for me to sit there and tell you the details when there are so many. But for me to tell you about how that felt for me is probably almost the same every time. It's very clearly the same that it comes through about that experience for me and how it felt in my body, how that what that created inside of me and what became of me as a result of that, I guess, is more about my story in a different way than it is about me describing in detail the actual event. I guess that's maybe where I would take it a little bit further. I think certainly you can talk about some of the experiences and some of the events and look at some of those, but I also think there's so much more to that trauma story. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does make sense. Thank you.
Okay.
But that sounds like what they're expected to do at that.
I do think it takes some time for a child to be able to go that deep inside themselves and try to say, this is how that impacted me, and it probably takes your help and for them to figure that out. And maybe they're just not at a point where they're able to connect those two. When we talk about the brain work a little bit down the road here, I think that if you help them to have a picture of that, sometimes they can say, oh, yeah, I get that now. That's why I do this. And then maybe they can help write their story through understanding a little bit more about what their brain and their body are doing. All right, shall we jump in a little bit further?
Let's do it.
All right. Let's look at the biological impacts, the studies of the brain. The brain is incredibly fascinating, and I really wish that I knew more about the brain, and I wish I were one of those experts that studied the brains and that maybe I listened a little bit more in my science classes years ago, but I didn't. So I'm learning as I go because it makes so much sense. And it makes sense for the kids we work with, too, to be able to have some understanding. And I think we can use some very simplistic terminology for them to help them to understand. When they've done some studies of the brain, and it's showing that it's looking different in traumatized kids. They're seeing some differences, some pretty clear differences in the, they call it the amygdala, the smoke detector of the brain. And I love that word, the smoke detector of the brain, because it's so visual for kids. So visual to say, I have this smoke detector in my brain, and when I feel danger, I feel fear, my smoke detector goes off. And when my smoke detector goes off, then my body's going to be impacted because things are going to happen, and it's going to send signals, and it's going to send hormones, and it's going to go through my body, and I'm going to be impacted by that. I'm going to be on guard. And when they study the brain, they say that the amygdala has become sensitive, overly sensitive in traumatized kids. So if you think about a smoke detector in your house that's more sensitive than your average smoke detector, if you burn something a little bit, the smoke detector is going to go off. If there's steam coming out of the shower, let's say, it's not really danger, but my smoke detector is sensitive, and so it goes off when it really didn't necessarily need to if it had been just your average smoke detector that kind of was able to sense danger a little bit more clearly. I'm on guard more often. My smoke detector is sensitive. It's on guard, and little things are going to set me off. Really important thing, I think, to think about and remember and help kids understand. The other thing that they look at is the hippocampus and the activity of the hippocampus and the size of that in the brain, and that the hippocampus has been shown to be smaller in kids who've experienced some chronic and complex trauma, and that the activity is slowed down, meaning that it doesn't transfer information as well. It doesn't transfer the information to process whether there's danger or not danger and how to handle that then. Which direction am I supposed to go with that? And when I sense danger and I get in my limbic system of the brain, I only do some certain things, and so I certainly don't always want to stay in that limbic system and only be responding in three basic ways. I want to be able to transfer information. And then what they're saying is that hippocampus is impacted by that chronic trauma, that amygdala is impacted. And there's some other things as well, but I think those were the two things that I really wanted to highlight for you. Very interesting, interesting research. It just gives us a snapshot picture inside their head. They don't understand what's inside their head or what's going on either, or why they blew up all of a sudden and why they weren't able to just manage a little bit better. They just know that they're feeling just anxious. So, let's see, what else? I put in some extra slides here that I didn't give you, and I just wanted to make sure that I'm covering what I have down there for you. Because of those sensitive areas of the brain, they say that a lot of these kids are hypersensitive to physical contact, and that's where you'll see some of the sensory integration interventions that are out there for these kids. And I just would want you to remember the safety with that and to go really slow with that. And at a rate at which they can handle, and we'll talk about that in the tools and skills, a couple of things to do with the sensory issues that I think can be fun for them and growing for them. Problems with coordination and balance as a result of some of the traumatic experiences, skin contact, medical problems. Certainly, if you look at the Center for Disease Control, you'll see a number of medical problems with these kids over the years that the stress, I think, alone, and being on guard like that all the time can just cause your body to be so full of stress and certainly impact you. Well, if you think about, think about a time when you're driving down the road and you almost had a near miss of a car accident. You almost hit somebody or they almost hit you and, whoo, you just missed it. And then you're back on track driving down the road, and think about how your body is feeling at that moment. And I'm guessing your heart is pumping, your heart's beating pretty darn fast, and you're breathing fast. You might be shaking a little bit. You're clenching that steering wheel real tight. It's not a very good feeling inside your body at all. And what is your brain thinking at that time? Well, when I think about it, I'm thinking, gee, I wasn't thinking a whole lot. I was sort of in the survival mode at that point in time. I was just in survival, and my body is just, like, trying to come down from that right now. And these kids, think about how that might feel to be like that most of the time, to be in that on-guard mode like that most of the time, a lot of the time, when you don't even know why that's happening, but it just happens because there's something out there that triggers me, and then I become like that. I might wake up like that because I've had a dream, and that dream just got me all off kilter for the rest of the day, and I can just feel that I'm tensed up. I think that these biological impacts are just huge within the body and what's happening to that body. We need to spend some time thinking about that in our interventions with these kids. Is how do we get them to work that through? How do we get that out of there? How do you get that out of there after you've had that experience of almost hitting another car? What is it that helps you to calm back down? What brings you back to a calm state, I guess is what I would say. And certainly you guys can all talk about that and think about that a little bit later down the road, but there's some things that you can do that are going to help you to get back down there a little bit quicker. These kids don't necessarily have the skills to do that. So you got my picture of the brain there on your PowerPoint. You'll see the amygdala down there towards the bottom of the brainstem there. That smoke detector signals the release of stress hormones, that fear instinct, lights up that limbic system. And that limbic system does three things, which probably many of you know, is that fight, flight, and freeze. three things that we do when we're in the limbic system. In that cortex, what they say is when that limbic system is lit up and it's working, what my understanding is when I, from what I've read is that that limbic system is working, the cortex isn't necessarily working so much then. So that limbic system is doing those three things, fight, flight, and freeze. So think about that with the kids that we work with. What might that look like? What might fight look like? What might flight look like or freeze? Fight might be something like, obviously we know those kids, those are the ones that are right there in front of us that are giving us a really hard time and wanting to just be angry at the whole world and fight and probably hurt people at times too. And flight might be something more like running away or avoiding or hiding and just not wanting to talk, not wanting to deal with things, wanting to run from it. And freeze might be like shutting down or zoning out. you know how you wave your hand in front of their face and you're like, hello, is anybody in there? And there's nothing, no response. They're just zoned right out. They're not even paying any attention, and sometimes we get frustrated, but I think it's that they're doing that, and they don't even know that they're doing that. One of the terms of this whole fight, flight, freeze, and that limbic system that I think is important to think on is dissociation and what that looks like in these kids. So let's go back to our driving down the road. You can tell I live in Michigan, right? Lots of near misses of accidents, obviously, here in all these lovely weather in the roads this year. But if you think about driving down the road and then all of a sudden you realize that you're a lot further along than you thought that you were, and you're thinking, how did I get from point A to point B when I totally zoned right out and I don't even remember? So we... And you're just saying, oh, no, well, you're the only one that does that, right? No, I know you guys do that, too. Dissociation. We dissociate. We check out for periods of time. I don't know about you, but when I do that, that is very stressful to me. I don't like that feeling at all because I think, oh, my gosh, was I paying attention? Was I noticing all of the things around me that I needed to notice? What did I miss? And that's not a good feeling. And I think about, why do we do that? Well, for me, it's because there's so much going on in my mind at the time. I'm overloaded. It's stressed, or I'm overloaded. I've got too many things to think about. And for some reason, I'm checking out, I guess, and I'm going there with it. Kids will tell me they do that in school. It's not that they're ADD, but it's that they're dissociating. Some kids are ADD. I'm not saying that no kids are. They certainly are plenty out there. But what I'm saying is these kids are distracted. They're distracted so much in their mind. They're stressed. They're overloaded. They get anxious. They get overwhelmed, and they dissociate. And we can teach them some tools, some skills to be able to stay present. For me, driving down the road, I thought, gee, Nola, one day I thought, I'm going to try this because I teach these kids to do this. I want to see if I can get it to work for me too. And I remember dissociating quite a bit on the way to from one location to another when I was doing consultation in different locations, and I just must have had too many things on my mind. So I took this, I was looking for something to eat in my car, which I didn't have anything, because I wanted to put something in my mouth, because that certainly would help me to focus on that rather than shutting down. But I did find an empty potato chip bag, so I took that in my hand, and I crumpled it, and I was crumpling it back and forth. In my hand, it was making a noise, sound, and it was also the touch. And I didn't dissociate the rest of the way there. So I know that there are things that we can do that will help these kids as well to not dissociate so that they can stay in the present, because it's not a good feeling for them either. And they don't really want to miss out on things. Okay. Shall we open it up for questions again? Any questions, thoughts?
So does complex trauma lead to low self-esteem?
Does complex trauma lead to low self-esteem? Is that your question?
Yes.
Certainly could. It doesn't necessarily have to, I guess, but it certainly could, partly because we're going to talk about a little bit further down the road that it's hard to develop an identity about who you are when you're always in survival mode. It's hard for you to explore. It's hard for you to venture out when it doesn't feel safe to do that. So I think in the context of thinking about self-esteem and trying to figure out who am I, sometimes that's difficult for kids to do when they're always in that survival mode.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Campus part of the limbic.
Hello, can you hear
me? Hello? Yeah.
This is Penny from New Mexico, and I've been listening to your lecture, and I work with the Navajos.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to agree with you. There are times, even the adults, but the adolescents, they'll just be staring into space. And I'll take my hand and go, hello. And then they look at me with like a distant look. And I have to agree with you as far as the trauma goes and the reactions. And the zoning out, I think it's interesting. So I agree with you what you're saying. Also, I remember in my undergrad, I took psychology, and I did a paper on mind-body and how it affected, how each affected each other. And I referred, to a chiropractor, and he gave me journals on how, like, the person's feeling anger, how it can affect the adjustment of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was very interesting how you brought the mind-body connection into this.
Yeah,
thank you.
They're so very interconnected. They really
mm-hmm.
are. And sometimes I think that we spend so much time focusing on the brain and getting
mm-hmm.
them to talk to us and tell me about that. Let's talk about it. I need you to talk to me about it. And they just aren't ever at a point where they are willing or able to do that. And if we work it through the body sometimes first, I think they can feel more comfortable to
mm-hmm.
then talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, all right. Shall we keep moving along?
Sure.
Okay, let's talk about triggers just a little bit. Triggers. One thing that I want to say about triggers is that we'll never know what all of the triggers are with the kids that we work with. We won't know, and they won't be able to identify what all of the triggers are, because sometimes there are triggers, something that will trigger them that they had no idea would trigger them. And so I think the important thing to think on with triggers is to help them to figure out, how do I get myself back on track if I feel triggered, rather than trying to avoid all the triggers, rather than trying to identify all of those and a particular thing to do with each of those. But what can I do to get back on track? What can I do to move this upstairs? We call it moving it upstairs in the brain a little bit more quickly so that I can process this and I can get back on track. But there are some key triggers to think on with these traumatized kids that they've identified. My friends Margaret Blaustein and Christine Kinnenberg at the Trauma Center in Boston have given a really good list of some things that are key triggers for kids, and they seem to be very real to me, and that's lack of power or control. When they don't feel in power and they don't feel like they have control over a situation, they get triggered. And that's because that's a really scary feeling. To be vulnerable is another one. And those two go hand in hand. If I feel vulnerable, if I feel helpless in some way, that's certainly a trigger for me. And so why do these kids act so controlling and try to take charge and want to be in charge? And if they feel like they're not at times, and they try to let that parent have control for a change, or the parent take charge, they get triggered at times, and then they blow up. Not to say that we don't want the parent to be in charge, because we do, but knowing that that might be a trigger for them, because if we look at historically what's happened to them. Unexpected change is another one that's a key trigger for kids. Those routines are so incredibly important for kids, so incredibly important for them to know from day to day. Routines create such a sense of safety. Those routines and rituals as well, those things that we do every month, every year, every day, those planned things, it helps us not to have to worry. We don't have to think about it because we just know that it's going to happen and we're going to do that. But we also know that life doesn't always operate in that kind of a box, and that if we can expect that change is difficult for them, we can prepare ourselves a little bit. And I can give you a little bit of an example of one little young lady that every time they'd go on vacation, the parents would take this little girl on vacation, it was awful. And they just didn't even want to go on vacations anymore because change was so hard for her. Even though it was vacation, it was supposed to be fun, she worried so much about what that was going to be like and how that was going to be different. She had to think on it too much. So we developed a plan for the vacation, and we developed a schedule that was at least more clear about where they were going and what that was going to look like, what was going to be in general, what that was going to look like, and she got to carry that schedule with her. And the other thing that they did is they took a map, and they drew the route on the map for her. And she got to have the map in the car and see where they were going, see how far she'd been, and that seemed to really help her a lot just to calm down a little bit. Still difficult, but some things that we can put in place that will help that unexpected change. Just working it through as best we can to help them through that, helping them to recognize that's going to be difficult for them. I think for the parents, especially though, if they can prepare and plan ahead, sometimes they can manage and deal with it a little bit better. Feeling threatened or attacked, and a lot of times these kids, that's another area that's a trigger. Feeling is the key word there. Feeling threatened or attacked. They may not have been threatened or attacked, but it's a feeling for them. Someone can look at me the wrong way sometimes, and I feel threatened by them just because of the looks that I remember from childhood that were fearful to me, and it triggers me in some way, and I can't explain it, and I wish that it didn't, and I know they're not threatening me, but that look gets me off kilter and off guard then, and I'm dysregulated, and I've worked really hard over the years to get myself back on track much more quickly, and I don't think it's quite as difficult anymore. But certainly there are just those, there's certain things that can't be explained. You just feel it. And we can talk through it and think on it. We can rewind the tape later and say, now let's think about why or what that looked like and how maybe you could rethink that so that you don't have to feel so threatened next time. But certainly those are key triggers. I think here is the part where I feel like it would be important for me to tell you a little bit about what I see inside of me as well. In that, which I said, if someone looks at me funny, or I think that they do, I feel that disapproval, and then that's a trigger for me. Sometimes I feel, you know, anybody know that show That's So Raven out there? She sees the future. I think I'm like Raven sometimes because I see danger coming. But the reason I see danger coming or I see something happening is because I'm sort of anticipating it all of the time. It's that on guard kind of mode that my brain is in. I think it's calmed down over the years. I think it's less sensitive, but I still see that. And I remember a couple of years ago going to sixth grade camp with my daughter. Has anybody ever been to sixth grade camp? Or taken a child to sixth grade camp? Well, if you haven't, you probably don't want to do that. It's crazy. Whole bunch of sixth graders running around like mad. So my first day at sixth grade camp with my daughter, I get placed in the first group that she gets to go to is carving. So they have these long sticks that they get to carve, and they've got these knives that they give each of them. And the guy, young college man, says, "All right, well, here's a stick I've been carving. Go ahead and carve." He says, "Just make sure you're sitting down." So they take these sharp knives and they're starting to carve on the ends of these sticks, and I see danger happening. I see kids just goofing around, standing up, and doing the young man not really paying much attention. But what I've learned to do over the years is I have to keep myself in check because I see so many things as danger. My husband says, "No, why did you just knock it off? You know, you don't have to worry so much. Just relax." So I look around, two other parents in there, dads, and another, a teacher, I think there was a teacher in there too, a leader, and they're all just sitting there hanging out. They were having a good time talking, and obviously I checked the register, and I checked to see, and they didn't sense danger. I could tell that very clearly. So I decided it was a nullifying then. But what happened is that I had already been triggered. I'd already been triggered that I felt danger. So I was anxious. I was worked up. And I decided that then I just needed to go for a quick little walk down the path and come back. So that's what I did. Went down the walk, took a walk, came back, and you know what? Everything was fine. Nobody came away hurt or anything like that. So it just went just fine, and it was a NOLA thing, I guess. But see, here's the interesting thing, because it was the next day, another group that was in the knife carving, a little kid did have to go to the hospital. So see, I do see like Raven. But anyway, Some of the triggers can be things like a season. It could be that the leaves are falling, and that can be a trigger, consciously or unconsciously. Could be a smell. Could be a sound, a voice, a tone of voice. Could be the scenery. There's so many different things that are triggers, as you can see. And it might not even seem related to the trauma, but in some way for that kid, it connects for them. So just helping them to recognize what it feels like to be triggered is what I think we can work with them on more quickly, is what it feels like. What are you feeling in your body when you're feeling this? When there's a trigger happens, what's happening inside of you? Because that's what we want to work on to help calm back down. Then let's head on to psychological impacts. Some of the psychological impacts, the thought process, as we talk about, self-concept, self-talk, safety, security, future thinking, lots of different psychological impacts. The self-concept, which we talked about, one of you had asked that question about the identity or the self-esteem, is that linked to the trauma? And what I think can happen with these kids is certainly that, because we'll talk about social impacts as well, and some of those social impacts, they have difficulty with relationships, and because they have difficulty with relationships, they feel like they are an outsider at times. They don't feel like they fit in, perhaps feel like they're different than others, which may have an impact on their self-concept. There's a number of things that these kids will say to themselves, and I think it's helpful sometimes to ask them, what do you say about yourself? What do you think other people say about you? What if you were walking down the street? What would people think, or what would they say? What do kids in school say? What do you think they would say? If you look in the mirror, what do you see? What can you say to yourself? And what I've noticed over time is that they have a really hard time with that one. They have a hard time coming up with good things to say. Certainly they can come up with things to say that if others have told them that weren't so good, that they aren't good enough, that they didn't do well, that nobody wants to be around them. People leave me. People let me down. People hurt me. I must not be likable. My mom doesn't love me. Nobody loves me. People keep leaving me. There's a number of things that I think they could say that would impact how they feel about themselves. Finding things that they can say about themselves that are good are very difficult. One of the key things that's important as the parents we work with is helping them to find good things to say to that kid, no matter what happened that day. Finding things, good things to say about who they are. And that's in our toolbox that we'll talk about in a few minutes, is finding things that we can say no matter what. And I know each and every one of you sitting out there with like somebody in your life, and I hope you have somebody like that that can say something good to you no matter how rotten of a day you've had and how horrible you might have been that day or what you might have done or said, but that someone could say something good about who you are, that core of who you are, and that there are those things, and I'm certain there are those things in every person, individual on this earth, and we have to help those parents sometimes to find those when they're so frustrated. The self-talk, another area that's difficult for these kids in the psychological impacts, which is connected to self-concept, which we talked about. Sometimes I call that stinking thinking when I work with kids, and they like that terminology, stinking thinking, and I'll say, where are you going with that? I think that sounds like stinking thinking to me, and then they giggle and they think about it, and they're right. That's stinking thinking, because when did that ever happen before? Well, it didn't happen before. Why are you going down that road today when you've been in this home for 2 years now? You've had food every day when you woke up, haven't you? So I wonder what you were thinking when you decided to go hide that food under the bed yesterday. when you took all of that stuff out of the refrigerator and you ate it all, I wonder what that was thinking. Well, that self-talk said, you know what, I don't know what tomorrow's going to be, and so I got to eat it all right now. I got to get as much as I can right now because I don't know if I'm going to have anything tomorrow. I don't know if these people are going to want me tomorrow. They say that they do, but I don't know that. And I start my thinking going. So going to school sometimes is hard for kids, and they start the thinking in the morning, and we help them to work on that. Helping them to come up with some clear things that they could say to themselves. I think in the self-talk area, it's a good thing we can do. We can write things on post-it notes, help them to write some things down for themselves on post-it notes. I think it's more important when it's in their own writing and in their own words, because then it's really their self-talk and it's easier for them to take it in, easier for them to keep it in there than it is if someone just said that to me. If I can say that to myself and keep putting that in there. Lots of different areas that we can do that with them, but certainly to recognize, let's try to figure out what are some of those things they're saying to themselves that might be faulty in some way. Another psychological impact is that safety and security issues that we kind of talked about with the flower, and that it doesn't feel so safe. My life doesn't feel so safe. My surroundings don't feel safe. I don't know what that feels like. I know that when I go to sleep at night, I'm not sure I'm going to be safe. Well, I'm not going to sleep real sound because I just don't do that. I think you'll hear kids say that a lot of times. You'll hear parents say, you know, they have to sleep with the TV on or they need a fan on. Or I go in there and it's 90 degrees out and that kid has a blanket wrapped around them as tight as you could believe. Or they just jump in the middle of the night. They're up and down. That can't rest, can't relax. Not feeling safe. We want to create as much of a sense of safety as we can around them so that they can begin to relax. Relaxation is so incredibly important, isn't it? Just so incredibly important to rejuvenate us, to be able to get up the next day and to keep moving forward. So routines and rituals there again, incredibly important to have some routines that we can follow through with, that we can keep moving forward with. I'm not a real routine kind of person at home, and I have to work hard at that. And I know that some of the parents that you work with might have a little bit of difficulty with that, but at least finding a few things that are the same. And if morning time is tough, then we create routines around morning time. Maybe that's where we turn the radio on and we sing the same song every morning together as you're waking up, and it becomes our routine. Something that we do that can be fairly simplistic, but that we can do consistently can help with that feeling of safety. And that we don't push them farther than they can go at any point in time, that we don't expect more from them in terms of that relationship building than they're ready for. Another thing to think on is the future thinking component. One of the things that they've found is that future thinking is not in their realm at that point in time for a lot of traumatized kids. They're not future thinkers. They are thinking in the present, and that's because they've had to live in survival mode so much. So when you think about what do you want to be when you grow up, what are you going to be like when you're 50, how old do you think you're going to live? Ask them some of those questions, and I think you'll be interested to hear some of the answers from them. I had one little boy not too long ago that I was working with that said, I think I'll live till I'm about 27 or 28. It just floored me, even though I know that they're not future thinkers, to think that he just didn't think he was going to live a long life. And he didn't really have a plan for his future. So when I don't have a plan for my future, I'm not thinking about future, and I'm just living in today, you can already start to see some of the difficulties that they might face as a result of that, some of the decisions they make, because they're not really thinking about tomorrow or next week. I don't need to do that. I don't care about that. It doesn't matter what I say. It doesn't matter if I do this or that, because really it's really just about today. And if I get through today, I'm good. The trauma story, one of you mentioned the trauma story and how that component is a part of that TF-CBT, which is very much so, and I think a lot of the trauma interventions out there the trauma story component seems to be important in helping a kid to move forward. What I think about that trauma story, though, is that it's so much more than me just telling you what happened, what the events were and what the details were, because honestly, these kids have probably told 10 different caseworkers that already. They've probably told I don't know how many different people the events and the details that they've had to sit there and tell the details, and a lot of them can do that without any emotion at all. Amazingly, there's no emotion. They can just sit there and rattle it off to you. That's not the story. That's not the story at all. That doesn't tell us what really is going on for them. What did all of those events and all of those details do? Who did they become and what did that create as a result of all of those events? And I think pulling together the impacts into that trauma story really helps them to move forward. I think helping them to relook at some of the details that might not be very clear, might not be accurate, that they might have put some things in there that are connected to their self-concept, which we just talked about, that are negative in a way that maybe we can help them to rework that they don't have to hold on to that that's a part that isn't really accurate from our perception, and hopefully from theirs down the road too, that they don't have to be what they see that they are. That maybe someone's told them or because of the way that they were treated. And another piece of the trauma story that is helpful is that we get to start creating a next chapter, another stage, a future, a plan, moving forward, that there's something next, which is something new for them, that they can say, yes, that's where I'm headed. I think that's a great part of the trauma story, is we put it all down, but we know we're going somewhere else now. We're heading out of that. And another component that they say is important is that we take that outside of ourselves and we share it with someone else. And when we share it with someone else, it helps us to start on that relationship, building that connection and that support, and being able just to get it outside of me. I can tell you I've written about 3 or 4 books in my head, and they're still in my head, and I haven't gotten them out of there. And I think that when we share what's inside our head and we get it out, it is just something amazing about that healing process to be able to do that, to be able to share it outside of ourselves. It demystifies it to some degree, and it helps it to move forward. Let's stop for another minute for questions, shall we? I sure do miss looking at all your faces. It would be much nicer just to be able to see all of you. Any questions?
The lines are open, Nola.
Okay.
We have a comment here. Can you hear us?
Sure.
Okay, go.
I'm very struck by how my work with adults is very much the same.
It's oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it lines right up with this work with children. A person could be 40 or 50 years old before they start to work on this, be aware of it.
Thank you for bringing that up. Absolutely. Because you know what? I don't know that it ever fully goes away. And it's like when we finally understand, though, or we get something, that key, that knowledge, it helps us to be able to move forward. And sometimes people have never really figured out what's going on inside themselves. Yeah, even at 40 years old, we still just don't know what's going on in me. And some of those things will still remain, but I think we can learn some really good coping skills to be able to take it forward. Other questions? All right, let's keep going. All right, let's talk about regulation a little bit in the context of the psychological impacts, the regulation issue. I don't know if you guys have heard that word, but it seems to be really popular these days, and I actually really like it a lot, thinking about getting myself regulated. dysregulation and regulation, self-regulation, co-regulation, all of those concepts, but about getting myself back on track in a calm state. And I like it so much because there's so much that's so natural about it. When you think about a newborn infant and the mother or the dad, the child is crying and the child needs to be soothed, needs to be rocked, needs to be sung to and held. And you're helping that child, that infant, to regulate. You're helping them to return back to a calm state. You're helping them to soothe. And that process of that parent and that child doing that develops that attachment, that bond, that co-regulation component of it. Many of the kids that we work with, we can see that dysregulation that they have. When we go back to the brain and you think about the amygdala, that smoke detector, being lit up so much, so often, for little things, it creates a dysregulation, and I'm just out of sorts. I'm just not feeling calm, not feeling relaxed, not feeling just in a normal state, just like the near miss of the car, that kind of thing. And how do I return back to that calm state? So we talk about that dysregulation, and obviously with these kids, co-regulation would be great. We'd love for the parent to be able to help the child to return to the calm state. Sometimes there isn't a parent. Sometimes we have teenagers. Sometimes we have adults. Sometimes we have kids that don't have a family. And we have to teach them some regulation skills on their own, too, and there's times when that parent's not with them. So they do need to learn some self-regulation. But you think about the natural progression of regulation, and that's in the context of a relationship, that they're learning regulation skills. They're learning that naturally. It's happening naturally, and they're learning how to get themselves back down to a calm state. A lot of our kids just don't have that at that point in time. So it makes a lot of sense to me that that's one of the skills and the tools that we're going to want to work on with them. Okay, so as a part of that, in social work and counseling, we've talked a lot over the years about feelings and about identifying feelings, expressing feelings, and we add the modulating feelings. How do I get my feelings to modulate, to run within this parameter that works well for me, works well for society and my social environment? So that extra component of identifying, expressing, and then modulating are key areas that we're going to want to work on with them. other psychological impacts, certainly we talked about that, that impulse, lack of impulse control, and some of that has to do with the dysregulation. The sleep disturbances we talked about a little bit not being able to rest, feeling like they need to be on guard, feeling like rest is not a safe place to be. Oppositional behaviors, like feeling the need to be in control, certainly, because when I feel in control, I feel safer. Okay, so then let's look at the social impacts so we can keep going and head on down to some skills and tools. Social impacts in terms of relationships. I like the word relationship better than attachment, and you can certainly choose to disagree with me, and that's fine. But I think attachment is a scary word, and it feels so loaded sometimes that if we just say relationships and we work on relationship building, I think we can get there to attachment, and I also think that it can look a lot of different ways and be okay. In the context of relationships, we need to think about trust. We need to think about safety. How do I let others in, and who do I let in, and support, identity development. All of those things are incredibly impacted by trauma, by those chronic and complex trauma particularly. Because we look at what is the meaning making in my head, what are those things that I put in my head that I say to myself now as a result of that chronic trauma. People aren't safe. I can't trust anyone. People let me down. people hurt me. When I trust you, you get rid of me. There's so many different things that they've developed that they say because of their experiences, that those are tough areas for them. And when you can't trust or you can't let anybody in, it's going to be really difficult to build relationships then. And when we go back up to psychological impacts and we think about the dysregulation, if I'm not feeling regulated, I sure am having a hard time just hanging out and getting to know you when I'm anxious and I'm really keyed up in my body. When we think about the attachment component, some areas to think on in terms of the impacts, the social impacts from the attachment area, is there's just that uncertainty about the world, that it's just not very predictable, it's not very reliable. It's scary to me. Boundaries are certainly an area that we see with a lot of kids. They have difficulty with boundaries, and they're not sure. How close is too close, how far is too far, when am I supposed to let somebody in my little circle. One of the things that I do with kids to teach them about boundaries is take a hula hoop. Set that hula hoop down on your floor. Ask them to stand in the middle of it. And then you jump in the hula hoop with them, and a lot of times they'll step right back. And that's because we talk about that zone of personal space and who do they let in that inner circle? When do they let people in? And what if somebody gets in their space and it isn't comfortable? What should they do, and how do they respond to that? What are those safe areas of space? Some kids would come right in and in my office and jump right on my lap, and they don't even know me, or rub my leg. And certainly you can see some of the opposite end of the boundaries there, that they get too close, and others won't are way distant outside of the normal boundary. Social isolation, certainly you'll see at times that because there's that struggle with, I don't know how to build these relationships, I haven't really learned that over time, that I feel disconnected from people around me. Another word that we talk about is attunement, being tuned in to others' feelings. Remember how I told you someone might look at me funny and I'll think that they are disapproving, but they may not be, and that's what you'll see with these kids, is that they have a hard time reading other people. What they think that they see might not really be what that person is really trying to express to them. That nonverbal communication is just such an important thing to spend some time on with these kids, trying to talk about what are you seeing? Where did you see that? How did you see that? And then asking the other person, so what were you trying to convey? You can play some really cool games with attunement with parents and kids to help these kids to learn to be able to recognize and read other people better, to spend some time trying to just relax and get attuned to that parent or that friend. And you could look in magazines and try to go through the magazines of pictures of people in magazines and say, now what's that person feeling? What do you think, or why do you think that? What does their body look like or their face look like that's showing that? So spending some time on that area, I think, certainly helps with attachment as well. Okay, so we went through biological, psychological, and social impacts briefly, but we went through that and we've covered some of those. There's certainly probably more, and we could certainly elaborate on each of those areas probably for hours and spend some time talking about what some of those kids that we see are doing in each of those areas. But we see that it's across the domains, that we're seeing impacts across the domains, and I think for a lot of your kids, I'm guessing that you'll see all of those three areas impacted by this complex trauma. So let's talk about filling up the toolbox. Hold on just one second. Let me take a quick drink. Okay. So filling up the toolbox. The brain knowledge, the trauma knowledge, I think is crucial. You can separate the brain into the thinking and the doing for kids, to make it real simplistic, and just do the limbic system as the doing and the cortex as the thinking, and help them to try to understand what their brain might be doing when they feel triggered, when you start to talk about triggers with them, and start to talk about what's my brain doing and what's that making my body do. You can draw a picture of the brain. You can show them that. You can talk with them and try to identify some situations and say, so were you in your thinking brain or were you in your doing brain? So when you're in your doing brain, let's try to figure out what to do. Let's try to think about how to fix that. What can we do with that? And that's where we talk about like the stinking thinking too and whatever terminology that you want to use. One of the therapists I work with used to make models of the brain out of clay with the kids, and then they could take it apart so they'd have the doing part inside the thinking part and be able to take those apart and really spend some time thinking about this. This is my brain and this is my body. Or laying down on the floor and drawing the body out on a piece of paper and talking about where is my body impacted when I'm feeling this, when something happens and I feel like I'm out of whack. Where am I feeling it in my body? Some kids might say they feel it in their hands. They start to clench their hands or their teeth, or they feel it in their heart, and they'll draw a little spot by their heart there because they feel that beating faster. Help them start to be more self-aware of what their brain and their body are doing. If you think about, like, what they teach kids with fire, when there's a fire or they're on fire, to stop, drop, and roll. And you think about why do they do that? Why do they teach them stop, drop, and roll? Because if they're on fire, I'm guessing their amygdala lit up, right? And then I'm guessing that they are in their limbic system, and they're not really spending some time processing in their cortex saying, okay, I'm on fire, so that means that I have about this many minutes before I'm going to burn. They say they don't. They need to do a quick response. And if they get this ingrained in their head, the stop, drop, and roll, they hope that it's going to kick in and they're just going to do that. And I like to take that concept with the kids that we work with and teach them some really basic skills that they can grab onto when they jump into their limbic system to be able to jump in and do something about it so that they don't head down that road too far. We see that sometimes they just head down so far and they can't stop themselves. Trying to figure out ways to help them to respond to these triggers and to get themselves regulated. It doesn't have to be stop, drop, and roll, but you can certainly get creative and think of something that works for that particular kiddo and help them to practice that. Just that understanding piece, I think, is important. And the one of you that mentioned about the adults and that you see that with adults as well. And I did this with one of my adult clients who had been sexually abused as a kid, and she was still struggling, and she's probably in her 50s. And I showed her the brain, and I talked to her about the brain and explained it to her, and she started crying, and she just really understood it. And what's really funny is she used to cancel with me so often because she'd be so anxious she couldn't come out of her house and come into my office. And she'd make it occasionally, and that was great when she'd make it. The next day after I showed her that picture and we talked about it, she showed up at my office knocking on the door wanting me to explain it to her again. She said, "I just tell me this. I was thinking about this. Can you just explain this part to me over again?" And the light bulb came on, and it just helped her so much because she understood what was happening with inside her brain and her body. So you can help kids to do that. I think that's a really good start for them. All right, questions?
Okay, Nola, I open the lines back up.
Okay, any questions?
I assume that one of the responses of children that would be in the fight category would be anger. So my question is, how could you help them, like with your illustration, stop, drop, and roll so they don't go straight to anger and fight?
Right. I think that each particular kiddo is going to be different with what works for them, but certainly there are some things that you can do with them, like, let's see. One particular kiddo that I worked with, he was pretty aggressive at school, and tended to want to hit people when he'd get frustrated or upset. What we did with him is he and I made a little stop sign that we laminated, and he kept it in his pocket so he could feel that in his pocket. You know, the shape of the stop sign is a little bit different, unique, and so he'd feel that, and I think that when he started to get angry, he could feel that, and that was his cue to say, okay, stop. If he could get himself to stop for just a couple of seconds, then we also learned breathing. So we learned some deep breathing and some ways to get himself to just take some breaths and smell the flowers and blow out the candles kind of thing, to get himself to calm back down enough so that he didn't just rush over and hit somebody. And all it takes is a few seconds to stop yourself, and they have a really hard time doing that. And I think it takes a lot of practice and a lot of doing it over and over again, and they're going to keep messing up, and they're going to keep messing up, but we just keep helping them to learn that over and over again in hopes that they're going to stop one of these times long enough to think just a little bit and get themselves calmed back down. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Sometimes, like with...
Can you hear us?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay.
Not so much a question, but more of a comment or observation. I'm a middle school kindness counselor, and probably the single most thing requested is from teachers and parents and that kind of thing is for kids with anger and anger management stuff. And 9 out of 10 times, once you start talking with them and you hear about their life, it's almost always, you know, trauma or a series of traumas. And you're like, you find yourself thinking a lot of times, no wonder they're mad, kind of thing. It's just, it's amazing they keep it together as good as they do. Because of so much of what they've endured, kind of thing. So anger is a big part of it.
Yeah, it definitely is a very big part of it. And you're right, no wonder they're angry. But certainly that we don't want to let them we want to help them to figure out a different way to get that out. Sometimes I think we send them away when they're angry to go handle it and manage it on their own. With the timeouts, or go to your room, go work it out, and or go sit there. Sometimes it's the sit there and the timeout at the corner. And I'm not a big fan of that for these kids, because if you think about your body being dysregulated, like after the near miss of the accident, and you just go sit over in a corner somewhere, how does that feel? I mean, I'd much rather go run around the block, because when I got done running around the block, I'd come back and I would be like, whew, there, it's gone now. So why wouldn't we want to do that with them? Why wouldn't we say, okay, Johnny, let's go outside and do 20 jumping jacks together. Let's go jump on the trampoline together. Let's just go jump for 15 minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about it. Because it's not about punishment so much as it is about helping them to get regulated. And if we can teach them how to do that, then when they get mad, they can get unmad. Other questions? Yeah?
Okay, sorry about that.
Yes, this is Rick. How often do children who've undergone significant trauma bring up issues of religious faith, religious belief? And if so, how does one sensitively handle some of what the children are bringing up? Obviously, some of it's going to be toxic. Some of it's going to be confused. What's your experience in terms of kids who want to talk about their faith, their values, their beliefs, and what are some of the challenges in terms of being able to respond to that in a way that is responsive to their vulnerability, to the, you know, very difficult time they've been through, the dynamics of power that always are involved in these kinds of discussions? What are some of your thoughts about those questions?
Well, honestly, Rick, most of the kids that I've worked with who've been traumatized haven't had much exposure to any sort of religion or any faith over the time that they were in their homes where they were experiencing the abuse. Although, certainly at times when they end up in a foster home or an adoptive home, they then are, it's become a part of the family's going to church and their particular faith, and and start to maybe question, why, I don't know if I really like this God thing because I don't understand why God would let these kinds of things happen to me. I don't think that it doesn't make sense to me why would a God allow these kinds of things to happen? Which I think are the same questions that a lot of adults have too about their experiences.
Sure.
And trying to help them to figure out what is it that, you know, what is it I'm supposed to get out of all of this? And this isn't funny. This doesn't make sense to me. And I think for kids, even teenagers that I've worked with, I've had a couple of really awesome teenagers who've really grown in their later years and have really used their experiences to really move forward to help other people. And I think for me personally as well, I think that that was my source of healing, was to be able to say, you know what, God gave me, he allowed these experiences to happen in my life, and certainly he didn't want me to just hide that or be ashamed of that. He wanted something from that. He wanted me to be able to go forward and to use that. But for younger kids, I think that's a really hard place to go with them. I really don't think that they're ready for that. I think they just need some love and some unconditional support that we can provide them to show Christ's love through us. I really think that that's really the best place to go, and that hopefully they start asking some questions down the road then.
Good. I appreciate that, Nola. Thank you.
Sure. All right. Let's keep going in our toolbox. Let's go to regulation strategies, which we talked about a little bit with the let's go run around the block or let's jump on the trampoline and that sort of thing. But with regulation strategies, that's a key piece, I think, for me. Sometimes that's even that takes the key focus early on for kids, because if they can't be regulated enough to work with me, they're in their limbic system. They're not processing anything I'm talking about, so I'm just basically talking to a wall. So I really just want to spend some time helping them learn to regulate. How do you calm back down? So what is it that calms them? What soothes them? What brings them back down to a regulated state? Is it exercise? Is it breathing? Is it splashing cold water on my face? Is it not somebody doing that to them? Them doing it themselves. Everything's about safety. Is it is it rocking? Is it music and singing out loud as I can sing? I know you all do that in the car when no one else is with you, right? Something that what is it that calms me back down, and really helping that kid to pick a couple of things to help them to practice regulating. And I like breathing, honestly. I think breathing's a great thing. Physical activity is certainly a great thing, too. But the breathing is something you can do most anytime, anywhere. And teaching them how to breathe well, and teaching them about belly breathing, and teaching them about really taking in some good deep breaths and practicing that with them, and teaching the parent that too, and maybe even teaching the teachers that too, about what can you do with Johnny to say, okay, give them the cue, and then they know they're supposed to start doing some of that breathing. Sometimes it's squeezing a pillow until you can't squeeze it anymore and you're exhausted and you can't, or you take the pillow and you scream into it as loud as you can until you can't scream anymore. It certainly lets out some of those chemicals, those hormones that were released because I got triggered and my amygdala lit up. Somehow we got to get that back out of there then. We can't just sit with it. And if you think about earlier for these kids and during the traumatic experiences, a lot of times they had to just sit there with it. If they were being sexually abused, did they get the opportunity to let it out, or did they just sit with it? And we certainly don't want to continue that kind of a process for them of just sitting with it. We want them to be able to figure out healthy ways to get it out. So what I encourage you to think on is the process of getting there, how to get to a regulated state, and not so much about getting a consequence for our behavior, because behaviors are often a mask of what's going on underneath that, but that process of getting there to get regulated, whatever that might be that it takes to get to that point. So let's see, we talked about breathing, we talked about the physical activity, not sitting in the corner, not the timeouts so much as the time-ins, but even time-ins just sitting there are not necessarily the best thing if you feel like they're dysregulated. And I know that I've had parents say, well, if I go jump on the trampoline with them, I feel like I'm rewarding them. And I say, well, do you want to teach them or don't you want to teach them? Do you want to punish them or do you want to teach them so the next time they do different? And so let's not consider this as a reward, but it's a let's go work out your stuff. Let's go work our stuff out together. Let's go get it worked through. And you'll see them doing the jumping jacks together in the living room, which is just amazing. And then the kid can calm back down, and then they can talk about it. That's much better than a punishment. So just that expression of feelings, all the things that you've been doing over the years in terms of feelings, expression, and identification certainly go along with regulation, but then that modulation component added on to that. let's see. So let's go on to the next thing in the toolbox, developing an identity. So somebody said, does this have something to do with self-esteem or identity? So what they're finding is, yes, it does seem to have some difficulties there. So nurturing and discovering who I am outside of my trauma is so important. I have to tell you, I never collected anything over the years. Never collected anything, and all my friends collected something. And I always felt kind of left out because I didn't collect anything, but there was really nothing I wanted to collect. And I guess that's just because for the first 7 years of my life, I didn't really think about collecting. I didn't really think about anything outside of survival because my home life wasn't that safe to do that. It just felt like I needed to make sure today and tomorrow were going to be safe. Today was going to be safe, and then tomorrow was that I was going to be safe as well. So when I think back about that, I think, gee, you know, I guess I just didn't have time to develop that part of me. So I decided I'd collect kids, and so now I have 5 of those. No, I'm just kidding. I'm done. okay, so anyway, emphasis on survival. So what do we do? So I think exploration games can be great. They can be a blast. It can be fun for them, and they can be a way to get outside of survival. Like, I don't know if you've ever drawn pictures on people's backs and they try to guess what that picture is. That can be really fun because I think exploration games using the senses where I am forced to use my senses. I'm like, no, not forced. I get to use my senses to try to get further outside of survival. So write on their back and draw a square and try to guess, have them guess what kind of a shape that you drew, and then you erase it so you get some touch there too. And then you draw some letters or something like that. Or maybe put some things inside a paper bag, and they get to feel around in there, and they get to try to guess what those are for a little prize or something like that. They're using touch, or close their eyes and touch an object and try to figure out what that is. And one little guy, I did that in my office, though, and I got to tell you, here's a safety issue again. I said, close your eyes. Let's play this game. I said, close your eyes, and you try to guess what these different things are that I'm holding. So he closed his eyes. And he started to try to touch this, I don't remember what it was, a pencil or a toy car or something, and he said, it's really scary in here, inside here. He had his eyes closed, and he was scared because it didn't feel safe, and I said, you know what, why don't you open your eyes, and we'll do it a different way. I said, how about I put it behind your back, and you reach behind your back and try to guess what it is, because that just wasn't safe, and that's okay. He didn't want to go that far, and I just didn't even think that that was too far, but it was, so I backed up. I don't know if you've ever played tasting games where you try to guess what something is. You close your eyes and try to guess what the different things are you're being fed. That's a way to explore. Smelling games, different smells of different spices and all of those kinds of silly things that you can do. I know it sounds silly and you feel like, gee, you know, that's just kind of a simple thing. It is for us, but for a lot of kids it's not. And they haven't even gone that far. You can see from the example I gave you with the one little boy. So exploration games, giving them choices and options whenever that's a possibility, not giving them control, but giving them choices and options, like do you want the blue cup or the green cup, what would you like to wear today, choices and options to say, here, this is start, I like blue, I really do like blue, yeah, that's a good color, I don't know about you, but I've found with kids, I'll have parents come in and they'll say, you know what, all he ever does is he wants whatever my son Johnny wants. He doesn't even think for himself about what he might want. He just picks the cereal that Johnny picks because Johnny picked that cereal. Yeah, because he hasn't ever been in that mode to go outside of that. He's just in survival. So whatever chances that you can help him to do that, that's great. Another thing I think is just to find something they're competent in. It's not easier said than done, I think, at times, because sometimes they set themselves up to fail. But I heard, and I don't remember the man's name, probably 20 years ago, I heard him talk about, he taught foster kids origami. Some of you might know his name. But I thought, what a cool thing. Not many people know origami, and a kid can learn that. And he felt really unique, a kid would, because they learned that. You can teach them how to make bracelets, or maybe it's athletics they excel in, or maybe it's music, or something that they can start to feel good about. That's me. I'm starting to identify with something. Something. I don't know. Maybe that's reading. I don't know what it is for each kid. And hopefully that between you and their parents, they can you can help to find something like that. I think the next thing, too, in terms of identity is identity within the family, that's important. Sometimes when a kid moves into a new family, an adoptive family maybe, that they feel like they're just a separate component of that family. So you develop some family rituals, perhaps, like a family cake or a family high five, family slogan. One of the therapists I worked with, she did family beads. So they would each family member would make a bead for the other family members. And say there were five family members, so each person would have five beads on their necklace, then one from each family member that they would have as a necklace or a bracelet or something like that, that identified that kid, felt like he identified with that family then he was a part of. Just some of those rituals can be important to help with that identity as well. Identity, I think it takes some time. It certainly does. And I think that it is an important component, but it's also a process of time. But finding ways to explore that identity is probably something that you can help them to do. Okay. let's see. Let's go to relationship building, the toolbox for relationship building. I know we're getting close to time here, so I want to keep going. Relationship building toolbox, safety first, nothing without safety. If it doesn't feel safe, then back up. Co-regulation, we talked about, probably the most natural, but it doesn't have to look like an infant in a parent. I don't want you to think that I'm saying that you need to feed them a bottle, that the parent needs to feed them a bottle and go back to that stage, but I think that it can be a natural co-regulation at the age that they are to be creative with that co-regulation. In whatever that might look like, maybe you both grab a microphone and you're both singing out as loud as you can, or you're doing Dance Revolution together or something like that to get yourself calmed back down. I don't know what that might look like, but co-regulation is awesome if they can both do it. We need parents that are regulating themselves first so that they're not so that they're in a state where they can do that work with the kid. And I know that's easier said than done when kids can get you to the limit. And if that's the case, then walk away and take a break. Communication skills, there we go with skill building, teaching kids skill building for relationships, helping them to practice how to communicate. One of the things in that area that's interesting to me, I used to run these parent groups for adoptive parents, and I had a dad was working in our program. He'd adopted a girl at 3 years old. She had been pretty severely neglected those first 3 years. I think spent a lot of time locked up in a room with her little baby sister towards the end there. And he'd had her, I think she was about 16, so he'd had her probably about 13 years. And was coming to our program because certainly she still continued to struggle. And one of the really neat things that happened while she was working in the program and he was is that she put a note in his lunchbox. And this is a young lady that hardly ever shared her feelings or said anything or didn't communicate much about feelings at all. She put a note in there and said, "I just want you to know." She made his lunch for him, and she said, "I just want you to know that I really appreciate you," and something about that she really loved him and appreciated him. And at the end, she said, "And by the way, don't say anything to me about this note. I don't want to talk about it." So she what she was saying is, "I can do this, but this is how much I can do of that. And if you talk to me about that, that's beyond what I can handle." So we talked about in parent group, what could he do then? Because he, you know, he really wanted to tell her how much he appreciated that and everything, but he couldn't. That was the limit. But we try to get creative then sometimes in our parent groups about how can we communicate with these kids when they won't accept us giving them a hug or telling them I love them. Then they act really naughty all of a sudden, so they don't want to love them. And maybe that's wearing a button with a smile on it, and you say, well, I'm wearing this button. You know what that means? That means I love you today. Or maybe it's texting them. They love texting these days. Or maybe that's a coffee can that you stick a coffee can in the room and you stick a note in there. I love reading things from people rather than hearing them. I can take that in so much better when somebody gives me praise written. Take it home with me and I savor it. But when you tell it to me right straight up front to me face to face, I don't take it in as well necessarily. I don't know why, but that's just who I am. And so you write me a note and that'll be awesome and I can savor that over and over again. Social skills, practicing, helping them in the office to be able to practice how to, what to say and how to say it, and just practice conflicts and practice, hey, can I play with you? What will work so that somebody wants to be around me? Because sometimes they do push kids away from them. Teaching them basic skill building. And I think in there, the other thing I didn't put down is just problem-solving skills, and that's one of the key areas of building resiliency in kids is having good problem-solving skills. Something that in a lot of kids just naturally develops over time as they watch people modeling that in their lives, and they get the opportunity to practice that at home and at school. And a lot of our kids come in and with these traumatic experiences and don't have problem-solving skills, and that's something that we can certainly work on with them. There's some games out there to do that, or you can make up your own and help them to create some scenarios and work on that. I think there's a parent toolbox, which is a lot that we've talked about already, and just really trying to create that safety and to co-regulate. Depersonalizing is a big one. I always make them repeat after me and say, it's not about me. And then they say, it's not about me, and then they really work on believing that. But the child comes to them with their own suitcase of stuff, and it's not about them. But if they don't take it so personally, they might be able to handle it a little bit better. On the resource list that Rick has for you, if you're interested, it has some websites that have some online trainings that are really awesome if you're interested, some information about different trauma interventions, and also just more a little bit about the brain and attachment and that sort of thing, some articles if you're interested in reading further as well. And I think that I have to stop at this point and give you 3 minutes for questions if you have any more.
Okay, I'll open up the line. Okay, lines are open.
Any questions? Anything?
Nola, this is Margaret. I don't have any questions. I think you covered everything, but I just want to say that I think that this has been a really good two-hour investment of time to sort of cohesively look at some of the issues that you talked about today. So I just want to say thanks. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Margaret. I'm looking forward to seeing you again sometime.
Me too.
Nola, if it's okay, then I will just give a quick wrap-up for folks, let them know a couple of logistical things. So, everybody, thank you so much for participating in today's session. Nola, thank you so much. For some of us who don't know a lot about the topic, this was an eyeful, but I know I certainly learned a ton. For those of you who listened in, we'd greatly appreciate receiving your evaluation of today's session and also hear your suggestions for future audio conference topics. So I am just about to send out an email to each of you with a link to an online evaluation. It really takes no more than 5 or 10 minutes. Your feedback would be really helpful. And again, hopefully will give us a sense of what are the topics you'd like to hear about in the future. Secondly, for those of you who are interested in obtaining documentation of continuing ed contact hours, please download the 10 post-training questions posted on our website in that email I'll send to you, I'll give you a link again to those 10 questions. Just need to print those out, send those in. It's an open book test kind of scenario. So if you send those in to us, we can exchange, send you documentation that you've earned two continuing education contact hours. And then lastly, I'd like to invite you to consider signing up for our next audio conference. It's scheduled for the last Monday of April, April 27th, again at 1 p.m. The topic will be using spiritually modified cognitive behavioral therapy in practice, an evidence-based perspective, and will be led by David Hodge, who teaches at Arizona State University and is a fellow at the Program for Research in Religion at the University of Pennsylvania. So thank you all for joining us today. And again, Nola, thank you so much for a great presentation.
Thanks, Rick.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Back to the